Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So as we get deeper into our retreats, hopefully that you're all having enough time and inspiration and some joy coming out from the practice of seclusion in this monastery. Many years ago, I wanted to make this monastery a community of hermits, to give people as much time as possible within the limitations of fairness and having to keep the monastery running and keep up the support of the people who feed us, to try and give as much opportunity as possible for people to go back to their huts, live alone, be comfortable, to be able to spend as much time as possible in meditation. And even though that sometimes you feel you might like more time, other people might feel they want less time, still it's not so much the amount of time we have as how we use it. And again, when I was working hard building up this monastery and I was the second monk, sometimes I felt that I really wanted more time for my meditation, but I started reflecting that how well am I using my existing time? And until I could use my existing time to the maximum benefit without wasting time thinking and planning or remembering stuff, if I used my existing time to the maximum benefit and it wasn't enough time, then I had a right to ask for more. So what it made me do is to actually to put my attention into not sort of what was missing, but what I had and how I was using what I had. The whole positive mind attitude of not fault-finding or complaining, but just looking what we have and how I can make best use of it. Because even now that, you know I'm a senior monk here and have many responsibilities and duties, even during a rains retreat, in the end the buck stops here. If there's any problems, difficulties, complaints, they always come to me sooner or later. So there's a lot of work to be done even as a senior monk. But nevertheless, I have plenty of time in my cave. And I always remember, even though that I may not have as much time as some of you, I make sure I use that time very, very well, because I know how precious it is. Some of you who have lots of time take that time for granted. For those of you who have little time, you really don't take it for granted at all. Every moment is precious. And having that attitude, that this ability, this opportunity to practice the holy life in one of the most perfect of places and of manners, is just a blessing that you don't want to waste it. You don't know sort of when you have the opportunity again. The days, the weeks, they pass so quickly, and soon we'll be at the end of the rains retreat. But that time is not yet come. Soon you'll be old and sick, but that time has not yet come. Soon, who knows, this monastery, this Buddhist society may all sort of fall apart. That time has not yet come. So where there's the opportunity, there's enough health, there's enough opportunity, there's enough freedom, there's enough encouragement. Please make what best use of that. Not with fear, but with a sense of being, applying oneself to every moment one has in this meditation retreat. I told someone during the interview time, don't think how many days are left on this retreat. Think how many seconds are left on this retreat. Millions of them. And every one of those seconds you should make use of wisely, so you don't waste one. It's actually being mindful. And of course that establishment of mindfulness, where we really sort of put our attention in what we're doing, it's essential to meditation, wisdom. It's essential to your happiness and well-being. So don't sort of fritter away that mindfulness. That mindfulness is like a resource. It's like, you know, money, which people work so hard to get. And maybe on a Friday they get their pay packet and they spend it on a Friday night in a pub on stupid things. It means they've got no money left to buy food for the rest of the week. Sometimes that's a simile for mindfulness. When we have it, guard it, cherish it, and don't throw it away too easily with heedless talk or with wasting your time. When it's there, cherish it. It's so valuable, because that mindfulness is like it is a controlling faculty. It's a guard of the mind. It can see what you're doing, and it can see what's really worthwhile. Without that, you know, essential mindfulness, one is like a blind person. If we're not totally blind, one is visually impaired. So one doesn't really know what one is doing or where one is going. And of course, that's been most people's lives. Because they haven't realized where they're going or what they're doing, they've had so much suffering and so much frustration, so much disappointments in their life. Remember that frustrations and disappointments, you know, and feeling angry, it's nothing to do with this person, it's nothing to do with you, it's just the nature of life. So we understand in Dharma not to blame anybody for those things. It's just we weren't mindful enough. It's not someone else's fault. It's just our own stupidity, that's all. So we never blame others. It's our stupidity. And the only antidote for that is actually making sure that one is wiser. This mindfulness, as I was just saying, always came along the way I was brainwashed in Thailand. Always coming along with wisdom. They always used to use the combination satipanya, mindfulness together with wisdom. Never mindfulness alone, because that didn't really make much sense. You know, even a person who's having sex can be mindful, but is it wisdom? A burglar, so remember Christopher Titmus, I think, was the first one who gave that simile. A burglar going into a house in the middle of the night is extremely mindful, simply because he just makes one noise. Well, let's not be gender specific. She makes one noise, and this, she gets caught by the police. So you're very alert and mindful, but of course that's not wisdom at all. So we need to have that mindfulness and wisdom combination. And it seems that you have to get to a little threshold, and once there's enough mindfulness and wisdom there, you can actually see what the mind is doing, you can see what the body is doing. And it means that you can avoid so many sources of irritation, frustration and distraction in life. But once you have got that mindfulness and wisdom, enough of it generated, especially when you're on your own, doing your retreats, meditating, walking, being by yourself, when it gets strong enough, you can actually see what's actually happening, especially as you're meditating. So once you've got established a sufficient amount of mindfulness, and you all have, should have enough wisdom by now, the amount of years I've been brainwashing some of you, the amount of times you've been listening to talks from other great teachers, the number of times you've read the suttas, you've got enough wisdom now, but sometimes we forget the mindfulness is not strong. Once you have that mindfulness and that wisdom together, you can actually see what's happening. And as you see what's happening, you play around with this mind in meditation by playing around, which you sort of see where you are and you see what's necessary to go deeper. See what attitude of mind is necessary, what way of looking, what perceptual framework would actually produce a state of letting go. Because the whole path is a path of letting go, a path of disappearance, a path of fading away. When it says there's a path of non-attachment, as I mentioned to someone, on the Awada, Sabbe Dhamme Nalang Abhinivesanaya. So all dharmas, the good and the bad, is not worth clinging to, holding on to, getting involved in. And, you know, Nivesanaya, it comes from the root of that is Nivesana, which means like a house, an abiding. It gives you an idea of what that word means. It's basically, no Dhamma is worth making a home of, making a nest out of. It all has to be sort of let go of, abandoned. And you know that you're abandoning things, you know you're detaching from things when they disappear from you, when they vanish, when things go. That's always the test that you really have let go. That what you let go of goes further and further away from you until it vanishes in the distance. And so to me, the path of meditation, the path of monastic life, is always unburdening oneself, letting go of all those things one's accumulated, either in this life or many lives. As I said, I think, last week, not attaining more things, not getting more certificates on the wall, stream winner, once returner, anagami, arahat. We don't sort of aspire for certificates and for more medals and achievements, because that's just more constructing a self. It makes the ego, our delusional self, greater. We all should know, if not by our experience, at least by our knowledge of the Dhamma, look, if there's no self in there, if there's no me, there's no Ajahn Brahm, there's no Ajahn Apichata, there's no Ajahn Wayama, then who is attaining all these things? How can they attain anything? How can you say that Ajahn Wayama is an arahat, or Ajahn Brahmali is sort of a bodhisattva, I don't know. How can you say any of those things? It doesn't make any sense whatsoever when you realize that there's no Ajahn Brahmali. So how can there be any bodhisattva? So what we're actually saying here is the way of our practice is these five kanda process, the thing which we give names to, is just getting into this process of vanishing, becoming more and more subtle, like it's disappearing, stage by stage. I know that my next book, apparently, is called The Art of Vanishing. It's a very beautiful title. And one of the great similes which, you know, I got from my education, which is a beautiful simile of the art of vanishing, which is a simile of the old Cheshire Cat from Alice in Wonderland. Sometimes English literature manages to establish these images which are weird and strange, but sometimes that they can be applied to these deep states of meditation, to the practice of the path. The Cheshire Cat kept on appearing and vanishing, then appearing and vanishing again, so quickly on the tree that Alice says, "You've come and go so quickly, you give me a headache." And so the cat said, "Okay, I'll vanish slowly." And then this Cheshire Cat vanished, little by little, first the tail, then the legs, then the body, leaving just the head, just slowly vanishing. And then the ears, and then the whiskers, and then the eyes, and lastly the mouth disappeared, leaving only the smile. And Alice said, if I remember this correctly, "This is very strange. I've often seen a cat without a smile, but I've never seen a smile without a cat." Beautiful English. And in one way of looking at it, it makes no sense. But for those of you who have got some deep meditation, it makes total sense, because that's what it's like. All these things start vanishing and disappearing as you let go. And as you go deep in the meditation, that's all it leaves, the smile, the mental happiness, with nothing being happy. That's the nature of this practice. We let go more and more, and the smile gets more and more deep. And it's nothing there to do the smiling. It's just the nature of irritations vanishing. They get replaced by a sense of relief. And that relief is perceived as happiness, as deeper and deeper blisses. And so one can test the depth of one's meditation, not by how much you've achieved, but how much you've let go of, how much has vanished, and the bliss which comes from that vanishing, the happiness factor. Not the happiness which is based on having things in this world or achieving or getting things, but the happiness of things disappearing. It's the beautiful happiness, the happiness born of letting go. But as we do this, you know, you can understand how the process works. But we always need to understand how it works, and this is where the Patanjali of mindfulness comes in. The great wisdom where we understand that all these teachings of the Buddha are not separate from the path of meditation, nor is meditation separate from the Dhamma. It's as if in this meditation is where we experience the Dhamma, as if it's like our laboratory for a scientist, where we find out the essential properties of matter and how the forces of the universe work. We do that in this laboratory called meditation, but they apply it to the world outside the laboratory. And our laboratory is this meditation where we learn what letting go truly is. And I said that we know we've let go when things disappear and we get a boost in happiness. And that's our path of meditation. That's why it's called samatha, because the word samatha means just resolving these problems. I justify that aspect of the meaning of samatha from the Vinaya. As many of you should know, the last seven rules for the 227 rules for the Patimokkha, the monks Patimokkha, and they also apply to the Bhikkhuni Patimokkha as well, as the seven Adhikarana Samatha rules. Adhikarana is the business of the community which arises from time to time. And Samatha means how to settle that business. How to have this irritation of having something to discuss, some resolution to agree to. We have to deal with that matter so we can be free of it. And that's called samatha. And I love that translation because it shows that in the practice of meditation there's a problem, there's something, an irritation which needs to be settled. Something which is pressing on us, until we deal with it, we can't have peace. And you can see those adhikaranas, those disputes, those problems, those quarrels, those disagreements, not between people, between you and your mind. And that needs to be settled. And how is that settled when we're meditating? Once there's enough mindfulness there, and then you see that, look, what you're experiencing, the state you've attained to so far, is totally irrelevant. Which is why I've told many of you in your interviews, and I've said this in talks, and I've even written it in books, I don't really care what your object of meditation is. It does not matter at all. What really matters is how you are meditating. Literally, the attitude, the perception you have with what you're doing. That is where the work of meditation is. Because we all know that another way of looking at the practice of meditation, of our practice as meditators, monks, nuns, novices, anagarikas, anagarikas, is actually to abandon these five hindrances. To somehow surpass these kilesas, these defilements of greed, hate and delusion. And I always focused on those, contemplated those. Where do those live? They don't live out there in the world. A delusion doesn't live sort of in the bricks of the hall in which we sit. Greed doesn't live, you know, with the food which you see. Otherwise everybody would be greedy for that food. And hatred doesn't exists between this person you really hate, because some people love that person. All these defilements, greed, hate and delusion, all these hindrances of wanting, not wanting, restlessness, sleepiness or dullness and doubt, I say they exist between the mind and what we're watching. It's a beautiful way of looking at it. Yeah, you might say they exist in the mind, but I think the best perception is looking at this observer, looking at the observed, and looking also at the space in between. Because this is a simile which maybe arose for me, when I used to watch movies in the movie theatre. There you were sitting in the seat. There was a movie on the screen. And sometimes one got connected. And when one got connected with the movie, one indulged in it, which meant that I got afraid when the monster sort of crept out and jumped on the person. And you got romantic when at last the lovers were united after all that trial and tribulation. You got excited by the car chases. You got all these emotions. And then I remembered I was just sitting in a movie theatre on this plush seat. I remember, what am I getting excited about? What am I getting terrified about? I'm just in a seat. And this is just a light on a screen. That's all it truly is. Just light on a screen. And there are actors in there. No one gets killed. No one sort of... The monster is only just some special effects. The blood in those days was only tomato ketchup. Just made to look like it was going to be gory. Of course, special effects have gone huge amounts of development since I watched movies. I don't think they use tomato ketchup anymore for blood. But whatever it is, you know, it's not real. It's just this illusion, what we invest in that movie. And I find that if I remember I'm sitting in a seat, and I remember that just lights on a screen, and I realize it's what I put between me and that screen is where the problem comes from. And it's a good simile of just a movie, because sometimes that people don't want to be wise. They don't want to sort of establish that panya, because we have the delusion that this movie is going to be fun. We have the delusion that this is not an irritation at all, but this is going to be really enjoyable, valuable, and we're going to have a great time. That's why we like to just get totally lost in that delusion and think, wow, this is beautiful, this is really fun. It's why we get lost in the illusions of our fantasies, just like watching the movie, thinking that this is going to be rewarding, this is going to be fun. It's why people disrobe, why they get angry and upset, why they get involved in all these things, because of the illusion that this is happiness, when really it's not happiness at all. It's just this terrible irritation. And you just go sitting in the seat, nice and comfortable and peaceful, remembering that you're not part of the movie, and you don't jump into it. That's where you find the peace and the comfort. So when one is meditating, whatever one is aware of, the great movies or the stupid movies, the comedies or the horror shows of your mind, remember you're just sitting in a seat watching all of this. It just comes and goes. It's not me. It's not mine. It's not essential. It's not a self. It's not real. And it's an irritation. You realize an irritation when you just sit in the seat and realize you're far more comfortable just sitting in the seat with your eyes closed than getting involved in all of this stuff. Sure, it gives you what we used to call cheap thrills. Enjoyment of a kind in the moment, but you pay for it afterwards. And if you just sit in your seat, letting go of all of this, you find you have far more happiness, far more peace. I think each one of you in this talk this evening has had some taste of peace, some experience in meditation or in life, which has told you that, yeah, there is much more happiness, fulfillment, much more meaning to be found in a peaceful mind than anywhere else, which is why you've meditated. It's one of the reasons why that, you know, I strive to teach people just to get even a taste of a jhana, just once. Just so you know what's possible, so you know where real happiness lies. So you know, you get what we call the taste of freedom. Just a taste, that's all. Just so that you know that out there doing things in the screen of the world, yeah, there are great movies, there are funny movies, there are romantic movies, and there are movies where you feel so happy, but it's not real, it's not substantial. It's just that bubble, as the Buddha said, you prick it and there's nothing inside. So instead, we sit here and we just watch. And it does not matter what we're observing. This is perhaps the biggest mistake people make when they're meditating. They demand that the meditation is only successful if what they observe is nimittas or jhanas, or at least the breath, or at least a bit of breath. And they think that they have to do this, and if they don't, their meditation is not succeeding. Again, that's just going on this attainment business again. Just thinking that, you know, success in meditation is all about getting this and getting that. It's again more sense of self. And it's that big sense of self in me which gets involved and spoils the whole process of meditation again. Always demanding you achieve something or get something out of the meditation. Always sort of assuming that if you sort of don't reach your goals, you're a failure. That's a sense of self acting. So understand that, notice that, be warned, and don't get sucked into that. It does not matter what you're experiencing. What is truly essential is how you're experiencing it. Our job is to practice. Practice non-attachment, practice letting go, practice non-ill will, practice kindness, practice non-aggression, practice gentleness, practice awareness, doesn't matter what, of. If you do that, it's not what you're aware of, but how you're aware, then you are a Dharma practicer. Then I say you're a meditator. People who watch their breath with ill will, with anger, with aggression, with trying to achieve something, yeah, they may be able to hold their breath for many, many minutes, but I don't call them meditators. People even actually manage to get a nimitta and hold it with great force and strength for many minutes. I don't call them meditators, I call them sort of control freaks, they're maras, controlling nimittas. Your own nimitta, not other people's, not paranimitta. Or you call it Atta Nimitta Wasawati. But if you do things like that, then all you're really doing is just creating more hindrances, more defilements, a stronger sense of self. So you find when you're meditating, you're sitting there, your eyes closed, what you're aware of is one thing, but please pay a huge amount of attention to how you're aware of this. What are you doing with this? Just like this talk right now, which you're listening to, how are you responding to this talk? What I say is not that important, but what you make of that is very important. Now, are you trying to record this in your mind and try and grab onto it and own it, argue with it, delight in it, whatever it is? What's your reaction to what you're experiencing? The same when you're meditating, you're sitting there with your eyes closed in your room or wherever it is. What are you doing with what you've got? Which is why that I always, in my meditation, I encourage other people to do the same. I'm no hypocrite. As I teach you, I practice myself. I always make sure that I put letting go between me and what I'm experiencing. Not letting be, but letting go. Because letting it be is almost, there's a slight nuance of difference there. Letting things be is almost, yes, you know, they can stay here. Letting them go is having that slight bit of nibbida which shoos them away. And letting go is what you do, or what you've done when these things actually do vanish. You let them be and they stay there. So you may have like a set of thoughts going through your mind. Fantasies, ill will, plans, whatever. Don't let it be. Let it go. Let it go means you are actually untying something. In the same way that, you know, another simile which I use for myself is, you know, I've seen these tugboats carrying these barges. Just recently, I remember this because we got caught in traffic in Frankfurt on the way back from the retreat center to the town center. And, you know, we're stuck on the bridge over the, I think, the River Main. It's a tributary of the Rhine. And Frankfurt, this is main big river there. And there was these tugboats carrying these barges full of goods. And just how heavy that barge was. And I imagine that's just like me. Tugging all this stuff behind me. And letting go means not actually accepting this, not letting it be, but actually untying that link between me and all that stuff which I carry around. Untying it. And when I untie it, the barge just stops and the tugboat goes merrily away, free of this terrible burden. So light, so free, so powerful. And so you can imagine what you've been tugging around behind you when you're meditating. All these aspirations, all these desires, all this past, all this future, all this thinking, all of your Dhamma as well, which sometimes is just drag you behind. So you untie everything. That's called letting it go. So I look when I'm meditating. What am I dragging behind me? And I untie that knot. There's an effort there. It's called letting go. That's the difference between letting be and letting go. It's like the other simile which I've used, that you're trudging along, you know, with this backpack. And you think all these things you're carrying around with you are essential for you, but they're just these heavy rocks. And I just see what those rocks are and I just take them out of the backpack. And I don't know if you've ever been sort of hiking in jungles or forests or mountains, but the heavier your pack, the more tired you get. And if you can somehow lighten your pack, life is so much more free, so much more happy, and you can get much further. So I just see just how I can let go of things. And let going of those things, you know, sometimes it takes a lot of wisdom to find out what those rocks are and where that knot is which ties you to the past, the future, all this aspiration business, all this wanting to achieve business, all this stuff which is made up of a self, all this stuff which you should recognize with your wisdom is things which you should be letting go of to be free. It's what the Buddha said. You know that. Monks like me tell you that this is how you get peaceful. So, practice it. You're sitting there, and what I'm experiencing, have I tied to this? Is there a knot between this I'm experiencing and this observer? If there is, untie it. Let it go. That's why it's weird. Sometimes you spend all this time trying to get hold of the breath. And now it's there. And I say, untie that knot. You think, goodness, the breath is going to disappear. I'm going to just fall asleep or I'm going to go restless. Untie the knot. If you find when you have the guts to do that, the courage, the inspiration, if you do it properly, the breath just changes. It becomes a much more subtle breath. If you have a nimitta and you try and hold on to it, it never gets anywhere. You've got to untie that knot. You've got to let it go. And then the nimitta just blooms and blossoms. Too often in meditation, especially in those deeper states of meditation, you've worked so hard to get there. And last you're in these deep stages. And you blow it every time because you've done the right thing to get there and you forget what you're supposed to be doing. Everything which worked to get you to this place is what you do now. You just let it go. Nimitta comes, nimitta stays, but you don't grasp onto it, you don't try and hold it, you don't manipulate it, you don't sort of think, wow, now I've got nimitta, I'm close, now I'm going to take it into jhana. Stupid. You let go of the nimitta. By letting go of the nimitta, if you do it properly, again, it blossoms, it develops into something even more beautiful. The coarse nimittas to the refined nimittas, the incredible nimittas to the jhanas, all because you just let go. So you look at, what am I doing with what I've got? And in those early stages of meditation, gee, there's so much ill will. I don't want to be here, I want to be somewhere else. Come on, Ajahn Brahm, get your act together. Come on, you know, you're just watching your body, you haven't even got past the present moment awareness yet, whatever it is. Sometimes there can be a lot of ill will in a meditation, otherwise known as frustration. That form of ill will where you're judging yourself and you're way behind where you think you should be. Ego again, sense of self. Where you are is where you're meant to be. So just be happy being here with a dull and stupid mind. If you can do that, it's just what you're doing with what you've got. It's what's between you and that dull and stupid mind. That is the most important. And what I put there again is just this beautiful sense of letting go. I'm not going to sort of be burdened with a stupid mind. It's not mine, it's not me, not a self. So if the mind wants to be stupid, that's its business, not my business. You can actually do that. That way you just untie yourself from stupidity. Untie yourself from dullness. Dullness is just part of life. So you just let it be. Don't let it be, you let it go. There's another reason, being kind to it. By being kind to life, you have this almost sense of warmth. There's this flow of life which comes this way and goes that way. You know that sometimes you're going to get a deep meditation, sometimes you're going to get just ordinary meditations. You can't have deep meditations every day of your life, every second of your day. Now, even the Buddha could do that. He came out of these meditations and then went back in again. So this is just the flow. So you're beautiful, kind to the flow of this life. You just let it be, you let it go, and you're kind to these things. The kindness to them, it gives it a sense of joy to what you're doing, because whatever you're kind to, if you've got a bit of metta towards it, you invest joy with it. So you have joy with what you're doing, and that sort of joy, you little put in that joy there between you and the object which you're doing. In other words, you have fun meditating, no matter what's happening. You have fun working in the kitchen. You have fun giving a talk. You have fun just cleaning the toilets. Whatever it is you're doing, you have to do it with loving kindness, with metta, with joy. Just like the mother with her child. And the child poos and pees and screams and wakes up and wants this. And the mother, don't know how they do it, just has joy. And that sort of joy with whatever you have to do in this monastery. Whatever task, which is even struggle, and you have to work hard, you have to sweat, or you just have it nice and easy, whatever you have to do in this monastery, give it that beautiful sense of metta where you invest a bit of joy. And you go so gently and patiently through this life. So those are like the three right intentions. And that's actually what I usually encourage, I remember to put between me and whatever I'm observing. At any stage of the meditation. Now the nekamma, the letting go, the renunciation. So whatever I experience, I make sure I don't own. Like the movie, I don't own that movie, I'm not part of it. It doesn't belong to me, I'm not tied to it. So that nekamma, and you can do that any stage of meditation, you're just watching anything, and you're just nekamma. Not me, not mine, not a self, none of my business. I let it go. Which means you don't manipulate it, you don't try and change it, you don't try and hold it, you just let it go. It's none of your business. When you do things like that, because it's none of your business, a great sense of stillness comes in the mind. That stillness is created, generated by the attitudes of mind which you've built up over many, many moments. I say, if you make many, many moments of peace, one after the other, you have this strong sense of peace. So every moment of letting go, letting go, letting go, letting go, you have a deeper sense of letting go, until the mind gets this beautiful attitude. It's let go so much, it becomes its nature. Whatever comes into the mind just goes out again. It keeps coming in and going out. Another thing comes in and goes out until there's nothing comes in, nothing left in your mind. You're emptying out. And that deeper state of emptiness you can get in your meditation is the deeper states of meditation, the stillnesses, the samadhi. The deeper you go, the less there is left. That's why you understand that stillness, emptiness is the meaning of samadhi. It's also the meaning of the Dhamma as well. So as we are meditating, we're actually experiencing the Dhamma, we're testing it out, it's our laboratory. The path of Samatha, as we calm things down, as we settle them until they disappear, also gives us a great experience of emptiness, of stillness, of deep peace. And certainly in my experience and life as a meditator, sometimes you've got so incredibly peaceful, you think you've gone to the end of peace. It's a limit. You can't imagine anything more peaceful. And then you go to another level of peace. And just the peace just blows you away every time. Just how amazing it is when you start to let go and things vanish. and vanish and vanish. More emptiness, more stillness, peace upon peace, bliss upon peace, and deeper states of emptiness. And, you know, you think there can't be anything left, but there is something left, and you let that go, and then you really start having an incredible, beautiful time. But it's not just for the sake of the beauty and the incredible awesomeness of those deep states. It's just how it teaches you. You're letting go of things, and this is what happens. This is why we say it's a path of non-self, a path of emptiness. Because as what you experience disappears, so that you disappear. The less you own, the less you are. You know, actually experience. It's not a theory anymore. It's not like a thought, a dhamma, which you recite and which you can translate into different languages like Pali. This is actually the experience you have of the self vanishing and nothing left. It's the experience you have of the will vanishing. So you just don't do anything. Nothing moves. Everything just vanishes. And it all starts because right now, whatever you're experiencing, you just let it go. Untie it. Don't own it. Don't try and get anywhere. Just letting go. Being kind, being gentle. Until these things just vanish one by one. And you just empty out. Sometimes for those of you who have accumulated many things in your life, it takes a long time to empty out, but it's still worth it. Emptying out even a fraction of what you have gives you an enormous state of peace and happiness, and also great insight into just what the Buddha was up to. And it encourages you because you empty out a little bit and you get this incredible, profound peace and stillness and experience of Dhamma. You empty out a little bit more and you go deeper. And you remember this is the path. So whenever you're sitting there in meditation, you're not trying to do anything with what you've got. You're not trying to sort of get rid of it. Nor are you indulging in it, like in a movie. You're just sitting there, realizing you're just in the seat, you don't own the movie. You're just mindful, just wise, letting things go. And you know you've done it right. When, first of all, the dullness disappears, the ache of the body disappears, time disappears, the body disappears, nimittas disappear, first jhanas disappear. As everything just vanishes because you've got this great attitude. Whatever's right there, you just let it go. Disassociating yourself from everything. Letting things vanish and disappear. So whenever you are meditating, whenever you are walking, whenever you are eating, whatever you're doing, it's not so much what you're eating, how you're eating. It's not so much whether you're sleeping 4 hours or 20 hours. It's actually how you're doing that. Are you doing that because you're trying to control or indulge? Or are you doing that just because you're letting things go? You're not owning your body. You're not owning your mind. You're not owning anything. You're being like a true renunciant. Someone who's willing to let go of body and mind and everything else. Someone who's got this idea in their mind, this what we call the Samanasanya, the perception of a holy one, a perception of a renunciant. Just not seeing how much one can accumulate, spiritually or materially, but how much one can abandon. Sitting down there, just abandoning, untying, untying, untying all the knots until one gets into this habit and the meditation just blossoms. And again, you just don't do anything. You're just untying. And the more you untie, the faster that tugboat goes. The less it carries, just the smoother is the ride. And so it just is totally free. And you feel that great sense of freedom in the deep meditations. That's why they call them liberations of mind. Freedom's a taste of freedom. What is that freedom? It's the freedom from desire, the freedom from attachments, the freedom from possessions. They're all gone. Physical possessions. Possessing your body, possessing your attainments, possessing your mind, possessing anything, all vanity. So by doing this, putting between you and that object, this great letting go, reminding yourself. That's maybe one of the great reasons why it works. I put this letting go between me and whatever I'm doing. Put kindness between me and whatever I'm doing. This gentleness between me and whatever I'm doing. Which means that I'm always seeing these objects, but my mindfulness is always on letting go. My mindfulness is always on kindness. My mindfulness is always on gentleness. My mindfulness is always on those things. And they're the most important. That's the first thing I see as I look through this window, this glass of letting go at the object of my mind. I see it through that perception. And because I see it through that perception, the mind does let go. I see the movie, realizing I'm sitting in a chair, not part of it. That's as far as that simile goes. Obviously, then you realize you're sitting in a chair and you let go of the chair. Then you're sitting with your body, you let go of the body, sitting with the mind, everything disappears in the end. But I think you know what I mean by that simile. And that way the letting go really happens. So in your meditation, if it hasn't worked yet, don't worry at all. Any moment, just sitting here with whatever you begin with, put letting go between you. Untie things, don't own anything. Don't try to get this stage of meditation or the next stage of meditation. All you can do, the only thing you can do, the only right effort, the only right intention, is in this moment just to make peace with this and let it go. To be kind with it and be gentle. You find the meditation just happens. It happens when you stop trying, when you disappear. The more you vanish, the more peace is there. That old Visuddhimagga saying, the path is where no traveller on it is seen. When a traveller disappears, when it lets go, the path just happens. Totally automatic. You just, the jhanas happen. Nimittas, they just come. Bliss just appears. So you don't do anything. Just let go to the max. Untie. That's the talk for this evening.
Sadhu, 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 sadhu,
Sutatipano Bhagavato.